Kids These Days.
Kids These Days.
This is Kids These Days.
Whether you are a planner or not, things don't always happen as you expect, especially when it comes to family life, a new baby, a marriage, a divorce, a death. These are all things that can cause detours in our lives. Today on Kids These Days, we're taking a look at the things that happen when you get off the path you thought you were on. We'll meet one family whose pregnancy meant a move to a new city, and another who moved halfway across the continent to create a new life. And we'll meet a teen who was asked to choose her path at a very young age. Plus, a new Dr. KTD. All that and much more this hour. Hi, I'm Jessica Cochran, filling in this week for Shanna Sheehy. Thanks for joining me. Today we're talking about detours, when life takes a turn you didn't plan for or anticipate. Maybe you've had that experience, a new job, a new baby, the end of a relationship, something that threw your life into upheaval, at least for a little while. We'd love to hear your story, comment on our Facebook page, or directly from our website. That's kidsthesedays.org. An Alaskan novelist gave us the idea for this program a few months ago. She wrote to us to pitch a number of story ideas, and she ended the list with this. I can imagine an entire show about life detours, including ones that ended happily, which must be a strong Alaska theme given how people often wind up here in surprising ways. Well, we wholeheartedly agreed, and so we asked her to write something on the theme of life's detours to set the tone for this program. Here is Andromeda Romano-Lax reading an original essay on her life's biggest detour so far, from Mongolia to Alaska.
I am a planner by nature, and one of my life plans was to be a travel writer. I married just after my 21st birthday, happy to have found another person, Brian, equally dedicated to global wandering. After 2 years living together in Nova Scotia, with side trips to Mexico, we planned our first truly grand adventure, riding horseback across Mongolia. In those pre-Wikipedia, pre-Google Map days, travel research was more challenging. We ordered an entire series of obscure satellite maps. We talked to a World War II veteran who had horse-trekked across remote parts of Asia. And we located a Mongolian guide who, though we'd communicated only by fax, was willing to purchase horses for us and guide us across that vast, wind-blown country. On a winter day in 1994, we were in a Canadian-Chinese restaurant having a celebratory meal while looking over the latest plans. My period was late that week. Prior to the meal, I'd stopped in a pharmacy down the street to buy a pregnancy test kit. Not that I thought I really needed it. Impulsively, I decided to use the little pee stick in the restaurant bathroom. I came back to the table, stunned with the news. There are indeed some trips one can make pregnant, but horseback riding in an alternately freezing and scorching wild part of Asia seemed just about the worst plan one could have. A few tears fell into my hot and sour soup that day. Not that we weren't happy, because we were. We'd wanted children, just not quite that soon. The true test of our feelings came a few weeks later, when it seemed I might be miscarrying. The prospect of losing this baby was another huge upset, which at least helped us know, when things settled down and the pregnancy stabilized, that this really was something we wanted, even if the timing was less than ideal. Goodbye, maps of Asia. Goodbye, horses, camels, encounters with nomads, Mongolian gares. Still, surely we could fit at least one little trip in before the baby came, couldn't we? We went to Mexico, a tame place we already knew well. The first week or so was fine, but then I came down with a toothache and a very bad cold. Even those minor ailments, combined with intense morning sickness and my changing profile, proved too much. Detour number two. We hurried north to Illinois, where both sets of our parents lived, and where we planned to pitch camp at least long enough to have the baby, before finding some entirely new plan for our lives. A few weeks later, we'd settled in, found mindless temp jobs, and were enjoying a day with Brian's father, Lou, a cardiologist. We'd spread out a bagel and lox feast for lunch when Lou changed his mind, struck by sudden indigestion. The discomfort worsened. We took him to the hospital. They helicoptered him to another one and put him on the operating table, but not in time. My father-in-law died that day of an aneurysm. My husband was 26. I was 23. Our first child was not yet born. My mother-in-law was suddenly and incomprehensibly a young widow. The rest of my pregnancy was a blur of funeral arrangements and time spent with my husband's distraught relatives and long hours of working dull jobs to save money for our uncertain future. When our son was born, we named him the Hebrew word for laughter, hoping it would counteract the deep grief that had accompanied his earliest days. Our first child and his first year were unplanned in so many ways. But as any new parent will tell you, there is little one can plan when it comes to children. Just having them teaches you that life, for bad but also for good, is bound to be one detour after another. Some detours lead to unexpected adventure. Some lead to unexpected domesticity. When our son was 3 months old, after Brian's mother sold her Illinois house and moved back to Toronto, her birthplace, Brian and I chose to move to Alaska because it was one place where we hoped we could find both adventure and domesticity, a place to settle down without giving up, a place to live the way we'd always wanted, while leaving room for the wild and the unexpected. We thought we'd only stay in Alaska 2 years, but 2 years have turned into 17. We couldn't have imagined how much we'd like it here, how much we'd bond with the place and the people, including people like us whose lives haven't followed straight lines or predictable paths. 10 years ago, I started writing fiction, and all of my novels so far have included some component of travel, transformative road trips and detours, both tragic and joyful. My latest novel features a man whose life is changed by a single 5-day detour across Italy. But in truth, nearly everyone's lives are one detour after another. And the best we can hope is that we find meaning and connection in those twists and turns, those delays and apparent dead ends, and the way that life conspires to change even our best laid plans. I'm Andromeda Romano Lax.
Andromeda Romano Lax is the author of The Spanish Bow, a New York Times Editor's Choice, and one of Library Journal's best books of 2007, as well as her new novel, The Detour, published in February 2012 by Soho Press. It's a novel about art, adventure, and second chances set in pre-World War II Italy. She lives in Anchorage with her husband and 2 children. Lying ahead, and it's a winding road. I've been walking for a long time. I still don't know where it goes. And it's a long I've been searching for a long time. I still have hope. I'm gonna find my way home. A few years ago, our producer, Sarah Gonzalez, took a dog sledding trip in Healy. There, she met the couple who owned the remote lodge, and they told her about how they met. Their unique and bordering on miraculous story stuck in her mind for years. So she recently revisited John and Karen Nierenberg at Earth Song Lodge. Here's the tale of how unexpected love detoured a single mom in suburban Ohio north to marry a dog musher she saw in a magazine, and how she, her rugged mountain man, 3 teenagers, and dozens of sled dogs all came to live together on a remote Alaskan homestead.
About 250 miles north of Anchorage lies the small town of Healy. A few turns past the business district of Healy is Stampede Road. It's a long panhandle of land that is surrounded by the park on 3 sides. At the end of this 4.5-mile road is Earth Song Lodge and Dog Sledding Adventures, a gathering of log guest cabins, a main house, a dog yard, and a coffee house called Henry's. All of this was built over the years from scratch by John and Karen Nierenberg, who greet and register guests in a welcome yurt to give tours of the dog yard each morning.
Here's the dogs. We've got 24 sled dogs right now, ranging it.
I visited Earth Song Lodge for the first time in 2006 to go dog sledding with John, an experienced musher who, in his single days, would embark upon 1,200-mile solo expeditions. We went out for only a few hours that day, but the experience was exhilarating. I recall John's last-minute instructions before we whipped out the dog yard gate, propelled by pure canine power. He said, never, never, never let go of the sled, the first rule of dog mushing. I didn't let go of the sled, and neither did I forget how John and Karen met. It's a story they told me later that afternoon when we were all gathered back at the lodge.
I was in Canton, Ohio, raising three kids on my own. I had been single for probably like 12 years, and I was also working for GE in finances and then going to college at night to finish my marketing and business management degree.
While working on a paper at the library one evening, Karen became distracted by the magazine stand. She left her studies for a moment and wandered over to browse. There she picked up the June 1990 edition of Alaska Magazine.
And there was this article called Lasting Impressions, Racing the Sun to Kaktovik, and it was about this guy that did a two-month solo trip alone with his dogs, and it was just amazing. I just looked at this picture. It was this little tiny picture of this guy. You couldn't see him very well, with this big purple hat and just bright blue eyes, and the story about him, and I thought, oh my gosh, I got to find out what happened. I'd never heard of the Iditarod in my life. I'd never even heard of a dog musher. And so for some reason, I just was so drawn to this story and this picture. It's almost as if I recognized this person. And so I sat down and wrote to the editors of Alaska Magazine.
Her letter asked whatever happened to the man in the magazine. Did he finish his journey? What was dog sledding all about? It was the first letter she'd ever written to a magazine. She mailed it off and nearly forgot about it until
a couple months later, I receive a postmarked letter and stamped Fairbanks, Alaska. And I just flipped out. I thought, oh my gosh, are you kidding me? And I was so excited. I started to cry and I ran inside my little house and opened up the letter. And the letter was actually from the person that the article was about, which was John.
Turns out, the day that Karen's letter arrived in the Alaska Magazine editorial offices, a letter from John also happened to arrive. He wrote,
to thank them for writing this article about him, but also to let them know that they misspelled his name, completely misspelled his first name, and didn't even get the last name at all even close right.
The article was about John, only not J-O-H-N Rienauer, as the headline stated. The real John's name was J-O-N Nierenberg. The editors realized that this woman from Ohio was writing to this same John Nierenberg, not Rienauer, and so they forwarded along her letter to him now that they had his address in Healy.
Living with the dogs in the homestead in a 16-by-20 cabin without running water and electricity, off the grid, all that, but living comfortably, you know, pretty simply, and then when the letters started coming back and forth, this is something I think that people nowadays don't realize the value of what mail used to be like. And if you live remotely in Alaska, even nowadays, you get letters. It's like gold. Yeah. And she was a pretty good letter writer. She wouldn't just send a one-page letter. She'd send something with a lot of heft to it, with some pictures. And so we just kept corresponding back and forth. And end of August is my birthday. And she sent me a birthday present. And I had sent her photographs of a bunch of my sled dogs. So she, with the help of our daughter, she cut out patterns for these little stuffed dogs, hand-painted them so they looked like my individual dogs on my team, glued them to a wreath, and there was something that she painted on the amazing Nierenberg freight dog team or something like that, and then sent me that as my birthday present.
John and Karen continued to correspond via mail. In winter, John would ski or dog mush out to a payphone to speak to her. One day, he told her that he was planning a trip back east to visit his family in New Jersey, and while down in the lower 48, he'd like to visit her and the kids in Ohio. Karen said okay.
And he said that as soon as he got off the plane, he knew that I was going to be his wife, as soon as he saw me. And he fell in love with my children, and he stayed for a little while and then went to see his family and then went back up to Alaska, and we continued to write back and forth to each other. I don't remember how long it took, but after a while, I decided that I couldn't stand being away from him.
Karen quit her job, packed up her things and her three teenage children, ages 12, 14, and 16, and drove to Washington, where she left the kids with her sister while she planned to settle into life in Alaska before bringing them up. She flew to Alaska in late December of 1991, a record snowfall year. John picked Karen up in Anchorage, and by the time they returned to Healy to start their new life together,
he had another 3 feet of snow, so all the trail markers are gone, and all the trail is gone. I had asked her if she had ever skied before, because that's the plan, was to drive up to the pullout and ski the a little more than 2 miles in. She said she had cross country skied before, but she didn't tell me she had only done it once. There was a friend out with some of my sled dogs, and one friend was out with a snow machine, and he tried to break the trail. The snow machine went about 100 feet and just buried it. And so we had to have somebody in front with snowshoes to pack the trail down for the skiers to pack the trail down for the dogs. So what normally is about it, when there's a trail, it's normally about a 20-minute ski in. In the wintertime, when it's packed really well, you can usually walk in about a half an hour compared to the summer, which is 45 to 50 minutes because of the spongy tundra. It took us 3 hours to get in.
And I kept thinking to myself, what am I doing here? Oh my gosh, this guy has better be worth it, because this about killed me to get all the way up here. And then he had to get the coal stove going, and it was so remote, and I missed my kids, and we didn't have, you know, any phone coverage or anything like that, so I couldn't call him. But I survived, and it just got better, and, you know, he took me out to teach me how to dog mesh, and I just did all these adventures that I never thought in my whole life I would ever do. And on the summer solstice, we sent for the kids to come up, and so they came up a year after we met to the day we got married.
John is solid, square-shouldered, with kind blue eyes and a large smile. He's mushed for 30 years and names his dog litters based on sci-fi television shows, Roman gods, characters from classic novels. One gets the impression that he's read many books on many subjects on these long solo expeditions. He's logical and resourceful, as most homesteaders have to be in order to live off the grid. Karen is pretty, ethereal, and artistic. Because of back injuries, she moves slowly with a careful grace. She makes crafts and souvenirs to sell in their lodge gift shop, a store she's christened the Denali Divas. She is the yin to his yang, like they are made to balance one another. Turns out, this was an idea Karen had been journaling about before she ever saw John in the magazine.
You know, when I told you that when I saw that article, I recognized John, and I didn't really put it together until I spent time with him. But then I went back and looked at some of the stuff that I had been writing, and I wrote journals. I've always written journals for years. And prior to even reading this article, I kept writing about this person that I was visualizing that lived in the mountains that was actually calling for me.
John had lived alone with his dogs for years. In the winters, when he wasn't working in Denali as a park ranger, he'd go to an even more remote cabin on the Kantishna River. He'd board there with his dogs, sometimes not seeing another human for 2 months. He thought it'd be nice to have someone to share his life with, but he just didn't know how he'd ever meet that person, given his remote, rustic lifestyle.
I have had friends that did adventurous stuff, you know, in the area here, park rangers, people living in the community, that were couples. And I did like the idea that they could, you know, two people could share these things together. So when I met her, that just seemed perfect.
And what of Marshall, Serifini, and Jacob, Karen's children? Serifini is now 36. She goes by Sarah. She lives in Anchorage, works for the state. She's petite and looks like her mom. She calls John Dad, and she just asked him to finally, officially adopt her this past Father's Day. She remembers the first time she saw the man who had become the father she never had.
And what is this? Who is this guy? And just, it was just folded up. All you could see was his picture, not the article. And she said, "That's my soulmate." And I was like, "What? What's a soulmate, Mom? What's going on here? This is the man I'm supposed to be with." And I was just in awe. And when he met us, we were just, this man is wonderful. It was immediately like, this is going to be my dad. He's wonderful. He took care of us. He showed us a part of our life that we had missed out, and it was what we had yearned for. This man, he cooked us cinnamon brownies. I'll never forget. It was just He was amazing.
The kids and Karen eventually got used to this new Alaskan way of life. But what about John? What was his adjustment period?
A person who's living used to living all by himself, you know, with his own routine, all of a sudden having a whole family. You know, the focus changed a lot from me just doing stuff with my dogs to, you know, providing for the family. So I spent a lot of time at home providing, you know, dealing with, you know, firewood and the basics for living, you know, hauling the kids back and forth to the school bus and just sort of doing all the support things. A guy who is very much used to all the privacy in the world, having the entire state basically, it's his own private place, all of a sudden it became rather difficult to get privacy. And it took a little getting used to. Getting on the back of the dog sled was the release there, because them moving up worked out so well that, you know, I didn't, you know, miss the things that I had beforehand as much. And they were all adventurous, and I was still able to go out dog sledding.
When the kids left home, Karen and John bought the 10 acres where their lodge is now located at the end of Stampede Road. They decided to get into the ecotourism business to share the things they love with their guests, Denali and dog sledding, and they have been for nearly 2 decades. Now they continue to operate their business and have expanded the lodge over the years, putting in a new septic system, adding more guest cabins, literally building their life together. So, what if Karen had never seen that article about John Nirenberg, not Ryan Auer? Would any of this be here?
You know, it's all these circumstances of how we met, but, you know, there's so many of them right beyond that. It's just, you know, it's like parallel universes.
Universes that eventually collided. For Kids These Days, I'm Sarah Gonzalez.
John and Karen Nirenberg own and operate Earth Song Lodge in Healy, Alaska, which is open year-round. We have photos of the couple, the original letter that started it all, and more on our website at kidsthesedays.org. This is Kids These Days. I'm Jessica Cochran. Each week on the show, we talk about issues involving family life in Alaska, and today we're talking about when that family life takes a detour. The major detour in Sharon McRae's life happened a long time ago. Imagine being faced with a choice about who would raise you and being given that choice when you were still a child. Today, Sharon is a thriving, capable, and beautiful young woman. She's a proud member of her family and a newly minted East Anchorage High School graduate of achievement. Sharon recently sat down with Kids These Days host Shanna Sheehy to share her personal story.
I'm Sharon McRae, and I'm 17. When I was born, when I lived with my parents, I lived with both of my biological parents until I was about 5. And then my little sister was born when I was 5. And then that's when we went to our first foster home, and that's kind of when the whole process of us being in the system started. And then when I was 8, I lived with my dad, and then that's when some drama went down and there was like a lot of abuse and stuff. So then I moved in with my aunt temporarily to get away from where I was, my sister and I did. And then that's when I had the choice to stay with my sister and stay with my aunt, or to move back in with my mother without my little sister, because she was already signed over to my aunt. So that was the decision that I had to make.
And you said you were 9?
I was 9.
Wow, so you were faced with a decision about where you're going to live, who is going to be the adult in your life, whether or not to be with your sibling at 9.
I felt like it was hard at first, but me and my little sister were really close. We're 5 years apart, so At first I was like, this is a really hard decision, but then I thought about her and what I thought would be best for her growing up and for me, like who I would rather be with, and then it wasn't so hard to decide.
Now, you say that you're 5 years apart.
Yes.
And that you're really close. So do you feel like a guardian of her? Do you feel like you have a responsibility to her?
I kind of do, yeah. I feel like I should be that other person. There's other people in our life, other women who are strong, but I feel like I should be there too. Because we're close in age, and I feel like I could have a better influence on her than an adult can.
So I'm not trying to ask you to go into detail about abuse or anything, but I'm just wondering, like, I'm wondering if you can tell me any more about that, to kind of give a description of what, you know, what adverse situations you've been in your life.
Okay, there was a lot of neglect. Like, my father's girlfriend had other kids, and so they got a lot more attention, and because they weren't married, he felt like he was in a weird situation because we were living in their house, so he felt like they should sort of have control. So there was a lot of neglect, and then physical abuse because we were smaller and they were a lot bigger than us. Yeah.
So was it like the kids who were?
Yeah, it was the kids. Well, just one kid. She had a son who was older than both of us.
So then tell me about your guardian, because is this your aunt?
Yes.
Also?
My aunt.
Okay.
So okay. She is my father's sister, my father's younger sister, and she already had a daughter who's a year younger than me. So then she adopted my sister and took guardianship of me, or my little sister that I was already with that's 5 years younger, and then took guardianship of me. So now she has us two and then her own daughter, and then our grandmother lives with us. She's really, I guess independent covers it. She likes to do things on her own. She doesn't like to depend on other people. And it shows us, it shows my sisters that we don't need to depend on anyone.
You know, among your peers, your friends at school and so forth, like, is your background from your childhood and just kind of having some displacement happening and some unrest in your family, like, does it kind of change who you are compared to your friends, or does it make you make different choices about who are your friends?
I feel like I make different choices. When it was happening at the time, I was in elementary school and I wasn't really focused on my homework because nobody was forcing me to do my homework, sitting me down saying, you need to focus on school. Nobody was saying that, so I wasn't really focusing. And then after it happened, when I moved in with my guardian, she was like, you need to do homework. We do homework here. We have schedules. You do what you're supposed to because it's what's good for you. And then I got into like advanced courses. I started reading more, and then I started, because I was in advanced courses, I started hanging out with smarter people, I guess, who made better decisions. So I guess it determines who I hang out with.
Do you ever think about that? Do you ever think like, wow, this is how I am, this is who I am, where I am, I could have been somewhere else?
All the time. I always think about, what if I had made the wrong decision and chosen against going with my sister? But I think this was the better path.
Sharon McCrae spoke with Kids These Days host Shanna Sheehy. Sharon is a recent recipient of the 2012 Young People of Achievement Award presented by YWCA Alaska. See a picture of Sharon and share this story with friends at kidsthesedays.org. You're tuned in to your listener-supported public radio station. Thanks for listening and supporting your local station in Kodiak, Dillingham, Chivac, Anchorage, Matsu, and Haines and Juneau, too. This program is distributed by the Alaska Public Radio Network. We record at the studios of KSKA in Anchorage. Still to come this hour, plenty of Americans have been facing the loss of a job in the past few years. We'll check in with one Alaskan in that situation. And a chat with a young Olympian.
Detour, there's a muddy road ahead, detour. Paid no mind to what it said, detour. All these bitter things I find should have read that detour sign. Headed down life's crooked road, lots of things I never know. And cause of me not knowing, I now find trouble got in the trail. Spent the next 5 years in jail. Should have read that detour sign. Detour, there's a muddy road ahead, detour. Paid no mind to what it said, detour. All these bitter things I find, should have read.
Laughter can be great medicine for many of the things that might ail you. Next time on Kids These Days, we're talking with an international humor educator and a comic dad about keeping our sense of humor as we navigate family life. Plus, little kids tell jokes, the science of good humor, and humor as a traditional Alaska Native value. All that and more. Join us.
We're back. You're listening to Kids These Days. I'm Jessica Cochran, filling in this week for Shanna Sheehy. And this week we're talking about detours, what happens when things in your life don't go exactly as you plan or expect. Next, we'll meet David and Amy Newman. For them, it was the decision to start a family, to try to get pregnant, that led to a major life detour, a move to a new city, and plenty of unexpected complications. A few years ago, they lived in Juneau. They're both lawyers. They'd been there about 7 years, and they couldn't really decide if they wanted to have kids.
And then we kept picking a time where we would try, and we kept putting it off and putting it off and being like, no, we're not ready yet. And then, yeah, we basically were like, okay, let's just start trying and we'll give it a year and see what happens. And if it didn't work, then decide what to do from there. Mm-hmm. And then I got pregnant like right away, pretty much. Like second try, we were pregnant.
The number one thing that I was worried about was I wasn't working at the time because, what was it, 4 months earlier, I had quit my job in Juneau working for the state to run for the legislature. And one of the reasons for that was is that I always wanted to do something like that, run for office or something like that, because I thought it would be fun before we had kids. So before we started trying, I kind of took that leap and went ahead and did it. And the problem was she found out she was pregnant, what was it, 3 or 4 days before the election? Mm-hmm. And so that was a little scary.
So we found out we were pregnant the end of August in 2008, and then we'd already had a vacation planned to like Seattle and Portland the first week in September. And so the last day of our vacation, I had some spotting, and so we went to the ER, and we were there for like 5 hours, and they were just checking. And then at the end, we got up to the ultrasound room, and she checked, and she saw the one heartbeat, and then all of a sudden, there was another one popped up on the screen. And then she was still checking, and then David asked her, he's like, please don't tell me there's another one in there. And like, I think he was only kidding, because who like thinks you're gonna be pregnant with triplets? And she's like, that's what I'm trying to check. And then all of a sudden there's a third one that just popped up on the screen, and I think I told her, please don't look anymore, because I don't want any more babies right now. So we're 7 weeks. Yeah, I was 7 weeks pregnant when we found out we were having the triplets.
Total shock. I think I was a little lightheaded anyway from not having eaten all day. And then by the time she kind of found that third heartbeat, I was just completely blown away, but excited at the same time. Worried in every emotion you could possibly think of in the entire world. I think I had in that 10-second span where the woman told me and I tried to exactly process what happened.
So triplets, shock enough, right? A pregnancy with triplets is automatically considered high risk, so Amy and David began flying up to Anchorage for their regular prenatal appointments. Then at her 15-week appointment, they learned a few things. They were having three girls, two of them identical twins, but there was a complication.
And so we found out we were having the three girls, and then that's when the doctor found out that Julia's identical twin had an encephalocele, which is some rare brain defect where the back of the skull doesn't fuse, and so a part of her brain was coming out in it's just like a sac. So
I was from I think the first day and reading about it, prepared that we were going to have a severely disabled child. And I was just trying to get myself in the mindset that I was just going to be the best possible father that I could be, and we were going to be the best parents that we could be for her. But overall, you know, I was scared. I was scared for Amy that she was having to carry three, and it's a very high-risk pregnancy. I was scared for the other two that were in there, that they were going to be okay. It was just a real up and down, you know, roller coaster of a thing where one day you're better, the next day you're not so good. And at the same time, again, I'm trying to look for a job so I know I can support them. And then try not to show really any sort of fear or weakness in front of Amy, because I wanted to be there for her as much as possible.
So I think it was always like kind of there in the back of my mind, like I may only come home with two babies, or I may, you know, give birth to three and then one of them's going to die right away. But I just try to not think about that and dwell on that too much. Like, there's nothing I can do to change it. So worrying wasn't going to help any.
Since now the pregnancy was super high risk, the Newmans moved to Anchorage, closer to the doctors. At the time, they didn't realize they were leaving Juneau forever. They did a house swap with someone and planned to return in April 2009, after the babies were born. Then, 30 weeks into Amy's pregnancy, another piece of news.
We knew the day before I gave birth. We went in for just the, by that point we were going in every week for ultrasounds. And so we had gone in at week 29 and everything was, I mean, as okay as it was. And then we went in at week 30 and she was gone. The doctor showed us her heart was not beating. And then I went into labor that night and they were born the next day. And so within 24 hours of finding out that Caitlin had died, I had delivered them all. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it was fast, which kind of maybe was a good thing and kind of not. I don't know. I go back and forth on that. Like,
not having too much time.
Not having too much time to really think about it. But then the bad side of that is they were born 10 weeks early and had to spend 2 months in the NICU. So so for them, it wasn't a good thing. Maybe for my own peace of mind and not having to, I don't know, care, keep being pregnant and knowing that she was gone would have been difficult.
The one thing that I obviously was the loss of Caitlin, obviously the day before they were born, and then Amy actually having to deliver her stillborn. And then we got to spend a moment with her in the hospital. Hi. I mean, you just, there's no anticipating anything like that. And there's no way, to this day, I'm still upset about it because there's never enough time. There was not enough time for us to spend with her in the hospital because at that time, you know, the girls had just been delivered and they were struggling for their own lives in the incubators and on oxygen and all that. And I look back at it now and I wish that there was more time we could have spent with Caitlin at the time, obviously. The loss of Caitlin is still very upsetting to both Amy and I, and we handle it in our own way, but unfortunately that pain doesn't really go away. It's always kind of there.
The two surviving girls, Julia and Gabrielle, spent 6 weeks and 8 weeks in the NICU, the neonatal intensive care unit. Julia struggled with breathing. On the day they thought they'd bring Gabrielle home, she had some kind of infection and had to stay an extra 2 weeks. David describes that time as awful, working all day, spending the evenings at the NICU, coming home to sleep and feeling guilty that he wasn't with his daughters. At some point, the Newmans realized they wouldn't be moving back to Juneau, and they sold their house long distance. Their realtor arranged to pack their belongings and ship them up. They haven't been back once, not even to visit. That's been hard for Amy to come to terms with. But it makes sense. Julia is missing part of one lung, and she has cerebral palsy. All the specialists she needs to see are in Anchorage, and she knows her therapists here.
And she's got a lot of appointments that she goes to. She goes to physical therapy twice a week and occupational therapy twice a week. And she's got a pediatric chiropractor that she goes to, and she also gets a massage to kind of loosen up her muscles. So it's difficult to watch her have to go through everything when her sister can just do it like it's nothing, and she'll have to lay down and watch all the kids go down the slide and play, and you'll have to hold her and do it. But at the same time, I'm extremely proud of her. She's very determined, and she really, Julia Newman, has been an unbelievable gift to our lives. And obviously, any other parent who understands this, that when you have kids, you beforehand, you can never understand what being a parent is like. And it really is the most awesome thing I've ever experienced.
We got thrown for quite a few more loops than I would have ever anticipated. But yeah, I think, like David, if I had to do it over again, even knowing it was going to turn out the way it did, I wish it would have turned out a little bit better and that we had all three of them and Julie didn't have the issues that she did, but they are good little kids and I'm happy with them and I'm proud of them and I think we're doing a decent job raising them. So
we're just so proud of them. And you just never know what life's going to throw at you. That's all it is. But obviously the two of them are completely worth it in the end. So if I had to, I'd do it over again. That's for sure. No question about it.
To see some photos of Amy, Dave, Julia, and Gabrielle Newman, head to our website, kidsthesedays.org.
You can make a plan, carve it into stone, like a feather falling, it is still unknown, until the clock speaks up, says it's time to go.
This hour on Kids These Days, we're talking about how the detours we take in life, whether or not we intend them, affect the personal goals we've laid out for ourselves. We spoke with one young woman who isn't where she thought she'd be at age 32. She had every intention of being married and having children at this point in her life. Rebecca Leanne is currently in the middle of a major life reorganization. She told KTD producer Sarah Gonzalez how it feels to lose almost everything, except hope.
I make plans every day. In fact, my parents told me that when I was little, I told them that my favorite hobby was making plans. So I'm always planning and making plans, and life has happened and I've continued to just stumble through it. I'm still waiting for that thing that's going to happen, my shining moment. I always thought it would happen when I was 32. When I was like 26, I found out that America's favorite age was 26, and I thought that was stupid. Why would anybody want to be 26? So I thought, 32. I will be 32 and something really glorious will happen. And my 33rd birthday is on the horizon, and I've lost my job. I've lost my truck. Lost my boyfriend, and I'm just waiting for my dogs to die. And I believe that something will happen. I will have my shining moment. I will come into myself. My next plan, obviously, is always my dream and hope for a while has been that I will get married and have babies and settle down. And I just am in the process of selling my house and uprooting my life and bought tickets to Italy. So that's not even remotely in the same vein as that plan. So I guess we'll see what happens. Life happens. It's just all me wrapped up in my idealism. And the ideals of my youth were really ill-founded. They were uneducated. They didn't know. And there are so many times when I'm cleaning something or my mind wanders and I wish that I could go back and talk to myself and tell my young self some sense and think, why didn't you choose a different path? Like, why did you choose that degree or whatever? Like, why did you do that? Like, your idealism, it didn't get you where you wanted to be. But then I remember that I had other things I had to learn and become a better person in a different way. And I know that I wouldn't want to go back. Like, my idealism was really self-righteous and sometimes mean-spirited. And I'm really glad that, if anything, even though I'm unemployed, that I think that I'm a better person. I don't think that I'm as self-righteous as I was as a young person. Not that I'm old, but yeah. I never trusted my parents to take good care of me, and so I just always wanted to be a better person, and I was going to do more for myself and be better. And I realized that I didn't really know how to get there. and what I thought was right and good was not, in fact, actually. Because you don't even really consider or think the fact that you need to just change yourself and worry about yourself and be responsible for yourself, and that other people need to be responsible for themselves and need to be empowered to be responsible and make good decisions for themselves. Instead, you think, yeah, that you're going to show the way and you're going to have all the answers when I, in fact, had no answers. Yeah, like I said, not one of my plans or ideals, they ever pan out the way that I thought, but it doesn't deter me from making decisions or plans, because as you start moving forward, things will happen, new ideas will come to you, new people come about, different ideas, and somehow, in some way, you get some job that you never thought of, or you meet some new person that, you know, I wasn't maybe necessarily open to meet like years before, but now I'm more open to befriending people, and I'm able to just move forward. I am not the author of my fate. I just don't believe that I am. I can't be, because if I did, more of my plans would have somehow worked out. And the fact that zero, like nothing I've ever planned has ever panned out makes me in some ways feel very like out of control. I feel like my life is just, it's not my own. But when I stop and take a breath and think about it, I also realize that I like my life, and that my ignorant self trying to make plans was not the best plan. It was not, yeah. What is that quote? Best laid plans. Well, whatever.
A fool in his plans, or that's fool is money. It's the one from Proverbs.
Yeah, something about even the best laid plans.
God laughs it up or something.
Yeah, it's just whatever. I mean, the concept and ideas is just, it doesn't really matter. Like. Yeah.
So you're okay with whatever comes next, or?
Yeah, I have to be, or I won't be able to get out of bed in the morning.
We originally met Rebecca Leanne and her family on our Siblings show, a close-knit animated group of full, half adopted and foster sisters and brothers, plus her mom and stepdad, all live nearby, certainly helping each other through life transitions. How do you get through the detours in life? Tell us at kidsthesedays.org or write us at mail@kidsthesedays.org. Olympic snowboarder Callan Chithluk-Sitsoff has had plenty of hurdles in her career. Big ones like an ACL injury in 2009, and smaller ones every day. The 23-year-old from Girdwood competed in the 2010 Winter Olympics in Vancouver. 2011 was her best season yet, and she's looking forward to the 2014 Olympics. She's currently in Salt Lake City, Utah, attending Westminster College. I spoke with her earlier by phone about what helps her get through the detours in life. So, Callan, thanks so much for speaking with us today on Kids These Days.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So you've been competing at, you know, the national and international level for many years now, and it's been the main focus of your life for that time. In your career, what has been the biggest hurdle or setback that you've had to overcome?
For me, there's constantly, that's the thing about sports, is that there's all kinds of things that are big that I've had to deal with, like injury, for example. That's obviously the number one thing that sets a person back in athletics. And so that's on the top of it. That's the number one hurdle that I've had to face, is when you get injured, it takes almost more effort to come back from that than it does actually like in the midst of competing. So that's the number one hurdle. But the interesting part of sports is that there's constantly hurdles. So it's not just one event. like an injury will set you back, but there's constantly, it doesn't go away, you know, from one thing, from little things like equipment failing or trying to find the right pieces of equipment that work for you, and maybe one race it wasn't the right equipment. So everything about sports, there's constantly, you don't always do well. It doesn't matter who you are. I mean, you could be Michael Phelps, you could be any of the iconic athletes in our world. And without a doubt, things have not gone 100% perfect for any of these people. And what sets people aside, I think, in athletics and probably in all facets of life, is the fact that the people that you see with success, or whatever you want to call success, the things that separate them from the people that are classified under not successful are the people that don't let the setbacks affect their continuing motion forward. So you're not going to win every race. And part of being a good athlete is adapting to that and viewing things in a realistic manner and continuing on and using those things to propel you and learning from them.
Well, for you, has there ever been a time when you weren't sure that you could get past one of those moments, you know, where you doubted at all? Or have you always just...
Yeah.
Yeah? So tell me about
I've
that.
Yeah, So a good example of that is when I first made the U.S. team, I was 16, and I was invited to be on the team. And then how the season works is you go from World Cup to World Cup on this World Cup tour. And so these are huge events. It's basically all the people at the Olympics are at these World Cups that you travel around competing in. And I had the most amazing season. I kind of like burst onto the scene and had really good results right off the bat. And I got a third place in my first World Cup ever, which is a huge thing. So I had this amazing first season of my career. And the second season kind of had all of these expectations and a level that I thought that I was at. And the mental aspect of athletics is just as important. So that the second season was a little bit tougher, and I think I had a little bit more pressure. I had a little bit more things that I wanted to do. That expectation kind of made me overthink things and, like, typical problems of, you know, athletic or competition pressure and all that kind of stuff, which is totally normal. But it was a real struggle for me because I had held on to the results that I had gotten the year before, and it was really demoralizing to not make that happen during that second year. Now, after being kind of a veteran athlete, I can look back on that and see how that's kind of a normal progression. And if you read any kind of sports psychology books and things like that, you can pretty much look into any athlete and see that there's always some kind of a moment like that where the expectation's there. And it's really tough to fight through that expectation and come back to a place where you don't have an expectation or you're more and just different ways you deal with your athletic goals. So that was a really tough year for me.
Do you remember there being, you know, I don't know if it might be people or things that you did. Do you remember if there was anything that just kind of felt like, okay, that feels good, now I can keep going?
I think for me, having the support of other people has always been a really important part of my snowboarding and how I got here. So being able to talk with people about these things openly is really helpful to, when you do have a setback, to be able to have people and resources to talk about it with. And that's always been really important. My mom's always had a really important role in my life. So for me, having a person to rely on as support and a support system is always helpful in continuing past those setbacks. And one thing that's important for me that I've always tried to tell people about my life and how I've gotten to be here is that it wasn't just me. You know, it's not a Disney movie where I'm the lead character and I find myself in this place by myself. It's taken so much support from my family and specifically my mom in getting me here. And when I was 15, the support from her in making the things that I wanted happen, you know, that's the only thing that has made this possible. So I think it's important for parents. I'm so grateful to have someone like my mom and have a supportive family. And it just makes me want to push the message to all people that help is always an important piece of being successful.
That was Callan Chiflik-Sitsoff, the first Alaska Native Winter Olympian, speaking to us by phone from Salt Lake City. Well, nothing throws your plans for a loop like an injury. Just ask Callan. And in an Alaskan summer of being out and about, there are plenty of opportunities for mishaps. But with a little preparation, minor incidents don't need to become major detours. Our own Dr. KTD has some advice about just how to prepare.
Here at Kids These Days, we can't say enough about getting out and about with your family in Alaska. Be it the backyard or the backcountry, your family will benefit from time together on adventures away from home. I'm Dr. KTD, Michelle Laufer, with a few suggestions on first aid supplies to have on hand while traveling with your family. If home base for your outing is the car, keep a stash of items appropriate to the season, including extra boots, gloves, blankets, a flashlight with batteries, and non-perishable snacks. Smaller first aid items fit easily in a backpack and can be readily grabbed to go when you reach your destination. Some families prefer to prepare multiple first aid kits for the car, home, camper, boat, etc. At a minimum, these mobile backpack-sized kits should include a first aid manual, a small supply of medication in dosage forms appropriate for your family, including acetaminophen or Tylenol, and any essential prescription medications, including epinephrine or an EpiPen if someone in your family tends towards allergic reactions. For on-the-go injuries, include moist towelettes, alcohol wipes, tweezers, antibiotic ointment, hypoallergenic adhesive tape, and sterile gauze pads, as well as Band-Aids. To contend with unexpected twists and falls, include instant ice packs. In cold months, you might include hand warmers or little hotties. For stings and bites, keep antihistamine, such as Benadryl, and hydrocortisone cream on hand. During summer months or at high altitude, also include a sunscreen and bug repellent. Finally, a jar of Vaseline or other lubricant for chafing, blisters, or dry skin protection can always come in handy. As your kids get older and carry their own packs on outings, include them in frequent updates of the first aid kit and encourage them to carry their own, minus the medications, with age-appropriate supplies. What toddler doesn't love to have a Band-Aid on hand to help out when possible? Preparation is the key when heading out on family adventures, so load up the first aid kit and head for the hills.
Dr. KTD is board-certified pediatrician Dr. Michelle Laufer. She practices in Anchorage. For more of her advice, head to our website and search for Dr. KTD. That's it for this hour of Kids These Days. Today's show can be found in full on our website, kidstheseDays.org. There you'll find our slate of regular bloggers, features from the show, and access to all of our archives. We had help today from Dr. KTD Michelle Laufer. KTD's regular host Shanna Sheehy reported from Anchorage. Sarah Gonzalez is our producer and web editor and manages the business end of KTD. She reported from Healy. Lost Lander composed and performed our original theme music. And a special thank you today to Andromeda Romano Lax for giving us the idea for this show. Shanna Sheehy will be back hosting next week. I'm Jessica Cochran. Thanks for joining me today.
Kids These Days is an independent production of the Content Producers Guild. The opinions shared on the program are those of the host, guests, and contributors and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of KTD producers, partners, or funders. Major funding for Kids These Days comes from the Association of Alaska School Boards and its Initiative for Community Engagement. The program is made in partnership with KSKA-FM in Anchorage and the Alaska Public Radio Network. Find out more about Kids These Days anytime at kidstheseDays.org.